there. Welcome back to the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. We are online all the time at npr.org/Bryant Park. It's that time of the show when we get out our screwdrivers and we open up your computers and we peer inside and we look at what you've been sending around your people. We do it in a segment that we call The Most. Dan Pashman.
I didn't know the circuit boards had that sort of info.
Aren't they crazy?
Pretty cool.
Yeah, they do.
They know everything. Hey guys, we got a most email here from Yahoo News. Pilots run out of fuel, pray, land near Jesus sign. Two New Zealand pilots, they're flying a microlight airplane. They ran out of fuel in midair. They were just, they're flying over these mountains, a lot of beautiful mountains in New Zealand, and they were just praying. They literally started praying. They said, "We're both Christians. Our immediate reaction in a life-threatening situation is to ask for God's help." And they literally had to make it over. It was like right in the movies. They're running out of fuel, and will they make it over the top of the mountain to get to the valley below where they can land safely? And they made it. They landed in a field, and they pulled up right next to a 20-foot-tall sign that read, "Jesus is Lord."
That's weird.
I hope this doesn't.
When you believe,
I hope this doesn't convince them to poorly plan in the future. Oil, we got Jesus.
Yeah.
Genie, what you got?
Most emailed on ABC. Okay, there's a cryptic code that I bet you did not know about that tells you how old your tires are. New information. If your tires are 6 years old, according to safety experts and some new research, it doesn't matter if you haven't even driven on them. They are not safe.
Really?
Six?
Yes.
They just deflate, even if they're just sitting
there.
Well,
I think the idea is that you can't just look at the treads to see where, that you don't know what's going on the inside of the tire. There's degradation after a certain number of years. Six is the magic number, supposedly. So the safety experts are saying the only way for consumers to protect themselves is to learn how to decode the cryptic code, which is embedded on the tire's sidewall. For example, the number 418, if you see it there, you know that little row of numbers along the inside? 418 would indicate, 41st week of 1998. The safety experts are a little bit miffed with the American tire manufacturers because they don't want to issue an alert. But tire manufacturers say there's no scientific information that can point to when a tire should be removed because of age. They're disputing it.
I understand how you put the penny in the treads, and if you can see the penny, it's too much. But
well, apparently,
six-year-old tires.
There's a number of car manufacturers and some tire makers, even members of this manufacturing association, who've begun to put some warnings in their driver's manual.
Yet another reason not to drive. That's all I'm telling you. Cars are money sucks. That's my opinion.
And you know, the new Chrysler Money Suck did not sell well when they came
name.
Out with that.
It's a bad name for car.
Yeah. And the GMC Poorhouse also, similarly. All right,
do you have something to share?
I have a most emailed on Seattle postintelligencer.com. Mm-hmm. And it's about, well, they have these PSAs, these public service announcements, and what they're trying to convince the young kids about is that you can't just say, "I'm going to go to college." You got to put in some preparation. You got to take the right classes. You got to save some money. You got to actually talk to an adult about it.
Mm-hmm.
So these PSAs have also lit upon this idea that we're going to have these kind of stock characters, and these characters will represent different classes you could take. So they have Napoleon, and he's supposed to be like a French class, and they have this ninja samurai guy, and he's taking Japanese lessons. And then the weirdest one is this gladiator who represents taking Algebra 2 classes. And here in this clip, I believe we have a clip where the gladiator solves for X, where X is the future, and the function of X is teach them well and let them lead the way. Let's hear that.
I present to you Algebra 2. Foreign languages. And finally, biology.
Make me want to take out
Algebra
2.
You will step up.
And it's a Beyond Thunderdome situation, and all these guys come in and then... Yeah, and then these kids come up and say, oh, I'll slay the gladiator. Look, here's
but
my...
the tough classes now.
Oh, jeez.
You need them to prepare for college.
Here's my review. Here's how PSAs work. Some guy in the ad agency says, oh, I got an idea. And everyone says, it's fine. They're not paying. That's a good idea. We'll let the young guy run with it. And it's kind of clever, but there's no focus group testing. No one ever says, oh, that doesn't make sense at all. So here we have a gladiator in Beyond Thunderdome representing Algebra 2. But hey, kids, give a kid a book and you'll give a kid a break.
They're a ninja.
They are.
Matt Martinez.
I have the most emailed, viewed, recommended at Yahoo, and also the most watched by America, and it is a surprise. Here is the surprise.
The winner by 12 million votes of American Idol 2008 is David Cook.
And that was a huge surprise. Everybody thought it was going to be David Archuleta, but there were 97.5 million votes cast last night. He won by 19 million. It was...
Aren't you glad? You're glad, right?
Oh, I am so glad. Before I go on, let me say I voted for David Cook because David Archuleta, he was not exciting. He was a brilliant, really good singer, but not a good
performer. Idol, not an
performer.
Idol.
He wasn't an idol. And this is, you know... Edward Wyatt wrote in the New York Times today about David Archuleta's performances on Tuesday that he appeared to be beyond nervous during his performances and that with a little more than a shake of a head, a shrug, and mouthing a thank you to the judges after singing. That was him the entire season. It's like, did this guy watch American Idol?
So he was polite?
He was thank you.
He was unassuming?
Thank you.
We were drama queens.
Here's David Cook's winning song.
This is... your American Idol, David Cook. Good night.
I've been waiting for my dreams to turn into something I could believe in. And
he has a nice voice.
It's a really nice voice. It's kind of a sappy song to go out on, but, you know, it's...
I love the sap.
It was very exciting. It was great news to wake up to this morning. I fell asleep... before it was announced, it was at 10 o'clock. That's like 2
know,
in the morning for me.
Night. So, 90, congratulations,
did you,
David
did you say
Cook.
97 yes. million total votes?
97.5 million
America
votes
America has had her say.
So that's more than in the 96 presidential election by 2000.
Good congratulations,
Lord.
David Cook.
That's a horrifying statistic. Ian Chillog, wrapping up the most today.
Good morning. Yeah, we got a most viewed from NPR.org. This was on... All things considered, it's a Robert, you know, they've been doing this great reporting from China. This is Robert Siegel doing a story about farmers who have had sort of the rapid urbanization of China encroach upon their collective farm. It's actually been paved over to make room for a high-rise apartment building. So he visited with them. Let's hear the piece.
Was there farmland right out here? What were people growing here? What were
they doing?
Rice and veggies.
Rice and vegetables, yes. You would never know it. Their former farmland is a rubble-strewn urban construction site in the Wuhou district in the west of the city. In 2001, the local government offered them compensation for their homes and fields. It was a take-it-or-leave-it offer, they say, 15,000 renminbi for each mu of land. A mu is about 1/6 of an acre.
Can you tell me from here, where was your house? Back here, behind this wall, where the construction site is. See.
That's Lei Mingfan, a slim, elegant woman of 45, a villager who has immersed herself in Chinese property law since all this started. Those buildings, she speaks of, are the high-rises that a developer built after leasing the land from the local government. The price the farmers were offered for 1/6 of an acre is what people now pay for every 50 square feet in a new apartment. For 7 years, this group resisted the plan to pave over their formerly rural village. They thought they deserved just compensation. They staged a sit-in. They stayed on after the water was cut off. They say thugs even came to beat down their doors, and they have photos of the damage. Finally, Lei Mingfan and several other women did something that is both traditionally Chinese and audaciously risky. Last September, convinced that Chinese law was on their side and that national policies are fair, even if local implementation of them is not, they went over the heads of the Chengdu authorities. They traveled to the national capital, Beijing, to petition the authorities there. And the price they paid was enormous.
September
17th, she was arrested. She was in prison for 80 some days.
How did they treat you in the prison?
They beat her.
They interrogated harshly and asked, forced her to say that she was the one breaking the law.
Ultimately, they had to leave, and their homes were demolished. Later, groups of families from the collective took the deal and got housing. The protesters have had to fend for themselves. Joe Defou is still in his house, which he built, he says, with his own hands. It's two stories, with two bedrooms and the living room upstairs. Mr. Joe faces eviction and the bulldozer. Bare-chested, wearing just a pair of shorts, he showed me how he and his wife plan to hold out. He has installed a steel security door.
That's strong.
The afternoon I was there, he'd just finished plastering over a living room window to make sure no one can get in that way. He says he will die with his home if he must. We tried to reach the prosecutor who handled the case of the protesters, but to no avail. My colleagues' phone calls were not answered. We first met Mr. Zhou and Lei Minfeng at the office of Huang Qi, who runs a Chinese human rights network. On a website that is blocked by the Chinese authorities, he tracks thousands of cases nationwide, which he says amount to human rights abuses. He says the most common kind of case nowadays is the land grab.
Most so-called land grabs involve Chinese government officials acting in concert with special interests. In this case, real estate developers, for their own gain. They buy land from peasants very cheap. The compensation the farmers get is just a few percent of the real value. That's basically what happens.
Do the farmers have the right not to sell? Can they hold out?
According to the law of the People's Republic of China, the peasants do have the right not to sell the land. However, during this process, the government often employs the underworld and the apparatus of the state to force the farmers to sell.
Huang Qi is an interesting character. He studied telecommunications engineering and made enough money in the Chinese business boom of the 90s to start searching for meaning in his life, he says. He found it in documenting human rights abuses. Huang exposed a mind-boggling scheme that required tens of thousands of Chinese workers to have and pay for unnecessary appendectomies. He defended a practitioner of Falun Gong, which is regarded by Chinese officialdom as a subversive cult. He championed a successful wrongful death case arising from the suppression of the Tiananmen Square protests of 1989. For his work, he was charged with incitement and sent to prison for 5 years. He got out in 2005 and resumed his human rights work. I asked Huang Qi if there is a line which, if he crosses it, would mean he goes back to prison.
It mainly depends on how we make our cases. We make sure to follow the law of the People's Republic of China, and we make certain we present our cases objectively and truthfully. Then, in my opinion, the line does not exist, at least in present-day China, because compared to 10 years ago, the human rights situation in China today has improved a great deal.
Our conversation with Huang Qi and our visit to the former collective took place a few days before the Sichuan earthquake. I went back after the quake to talk about it with Mr. Huang, whose website has turned its attention to earthquake relief. He says the government should be more open to foreign assistance and to grassroots spontaneous relief efforts, as opposed to insisting that efforts all be organized by the government. I asked him if by criticizing the government about this, he wasn't taking big risks at a moment of intensified patriotism.
Yes, but we've been doing this for over 10 years. It's nothing new, and we consider it our God-given duty to criticize and to bring attention to this. As a matter of fact, over the past few days, we have seen some good things the government has done, and some bad things. One of the good things, for example, is a relative openness to the media. Openness of information will prevent unnecessary panic.
The earthquake has redirected everyone's attention here, but inevitably it will multiply the questions and allegations of land grabs. If villages or whole towns are to be demolished or rebuilt, who'll be compensated? And who'll do the building? Who will benefit from the bulldozer? And who will be its victims? Questions for this rapidly growing region around Chengdu, China.
That was NPR's Robert Siegel reporting. Thank you.